It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Under proposal from the state's top business group, all businesses in Wisconsin could reopen next Monday with measures to reduce the spread of COVID-19. We'll talk about how their proposal would work coming up. First, childhood mental health problems, especially anxiety disorders, have become a lot more common in the last 10 to 15 years. While the reasons aren't entirely clear, one thing is certain: it can be a big challenge for parents and children. Finding a balance between protecting your kids from unhappiness and letting them work through their own fears is easier said than done, but an emerging school of therapy is helping parents acknowledge their kids' anxieties while giving them the tools to succeed in the long run. Kate Julian is a senior editor for The Atlantic. Her recent cover story is called "What Happened to American Childhood." Kate, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Kate, can you start us off with giving us a sense of a scope of the problem here, this big increase in anxiety and other problems among kids? What are we seeing?
So we started to look into this question of childhood mental health because there had been so many distressing and concerning numbers coming out over the past 10 years. The most eye-catching ones may involve the suicide rate for adolescents and for children. We know that as suicides among all Americans have increased this century, they've increased more sharply among younger ones. So from 10 to 24-year-olds, we've gone up by about 50%, a little more. And for kids like ages 5 to 11, the rate has more than doubled. We also know that depression has become much more common. I think something like 20% of teen girls now have an incidence of major depression in a year. We also know that anxiety diagnoses and symptoms of anxiety have gone up by about 17%. And when I started asking around, doing early reporting for this piece and asking experts sort of what should we be most concerned about and what can we do something about, anxiety was the one thing that they focused on sort of to a person. And that's because anxiety turns out to be a gateway to other mental health problems later on. It's also much more treatable than those other problems. So it's a really important target for prevention. Happily, we know a lot more about how it works.
Are we seeing that kind of increase in anxiety as well, alongside that increase in depression and suicide you talked about?
Yeah, so with all of these things, with the exception of suicide, of course, it can be a bit tricky to know how much is due to increased awareness and diagnosis and how much is an actual increase in prevalence. It does appear that actual anxiety disorders are increasing when we look at the percentage of kids who are experiencing various symptoms as reported to healthcare providers. Certainly, increased diagnosis and awareness is also, is also part of what's going on. But what's really fascinating here is that even without the increase, we now know from research that's been going on for the past few decades that anxiety disorders are much, much more common in childhood than we once realized they were. Sort of the increase notwithstanding, this is much more widespread than when we once thought that it was. And we know that because researchers have done these longitudinal long-term studies where they look at adults who have various problems ranging from depression to addiction. And when they go back and try to figure out when did their symptoms first start, most often the answer is in childhood with an anxiety disorder.
That's one of the things in your piece one of the many things in your piece, not only that surprised me, Kate, this idea that anxiety in an early age, anxiety in and of itself can be a big problem, but it's also like the kernel, the germ of later and related mental health concerns. Can you talk about how that starting point of anxiety at an early age can lead to so many different problems down the road?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to emphasize here is that having an anxiety disorder in childhood by no means dooms you to a lifetime of unhappiness, right? Most kids who have anxiety disorders are going to go on to be perfectly fine. But the reverse is not true. You know, most people who are not perfectly fine in adulthood, as I said, did start out with anxiety in childhood. We know that the average onset age for an anxiety disorder or symptoms thereof is 11. And for some anxiety disorders, such as separation anxiety, which is a common one in childhood, or phobia, it can start earlier, even, as early as 7 in some cases on average. And what tends to happen is that because we as parents misunderstand what anxiety is and what an anxiety disorder is, we respond to it in a way that doesn't set kids up to learn to deal with their problems in the long term. Let me back up really quickly and just say a bit more about that. So when we hear the word anxiety, we tend to think this is a problem, this is pathological. And the truth is, anxiety is a universal human emotion. So stress, worry are part of life. They're part of life for everybody. Everybody is going to encounter them at one point. What researchers have found is that when people don't learn to tolerate the feelings of stress and worry and the anxiety that they provoke, that then they begin to do anything and everything they can to avoid the things that cause them those feelings. And that's when you wind up with a situation where the anxiety is ongoing. It doesn't remit. It doesn't relax when circumstances do and when it starts to really control your life.
We're talking to Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic, talking about anxiety, kids, and parenting and possible solutions to anxiety problems at an early age. And Kate, you talked to a lot of people about this, and they pointed you toward one school of thought, one kind of treatment, often focusing on parents and how they react when they see those early instances of anxiety. What kind of things did you find out?
So we know that anxiety in general, so for kids and adults, is really responsive to cognitive behavioral therapy. This is the gold standard treatment for anxiety. It's the gold standard treatment for a number of mental health conditions, but it works even better for anxiety than it does for things like depression. The problem is it requires a lot of motivation on the part of the patient. So anxiety, if we say anxiety, sort of the hallmark of anxiety is avoiding things that stress you out, right? So the hallmark of CBT, experts like to say, is exposure to those things so that you learn to tolerate this discomfort, you learn to be resilient. But if you're a young kid, you may not always want to do that, right? Let's say you have intense separation anxiety, intense social anxiety. The last thing you may want to do is go and expose yourself to those things and do that hard work. So what's emerging now is another approach which uses some of the same principles of helping kids to learn to confront the things that trouble them. But by working with parents directly instead of kids, you can reach kids who may not be so motivated to get help. A particularly interesting example of this, which I discuss in the piece, is a program known as the SPACE program, which is out of Yale's Child Study Center, and it's led by a researcher named Ellie Leibowitz. And they have found that over a 12-week course of treatment where they meet with the parents once a week and help them to learn to do, to essentially back off a bit, stop bubble wrapping their kids, stop protecting their kids from the things that their kids worry about, that they have results which are really, really hot, really, really effective, right? So something like 2/3 of kids have a very substantial reduction in their anxiety symptoms. And based on the research so far, the gains from this treatment seem to be really robust and lasting.
And some of the researchers you talked to made the point like, hey, we're not blaming parents. You're not bad parents here. But a parenting instinct or one reaction from parents, I'm a parent myself, I've been here, something bad is happening to your kid. It's making them unhappy. You want to protect them from that. Can you talk about that reaction and how it may in the long run be counterproductive?
Yes. So this is such an important point. I am a parent myself. Okay. I do not want anybody to leave this discussion or this article with the idea that parents caused some form of mental illness or are to blame for it. There's a long history in psychology of blaming parents for things. It's not an entirely good history. So we want to be really careful of this. That being said, this notion that underlies the treatment I was just discussing, the SPACE program, is really helpful. They refer, these researchers who focus on childhood anxiety and the role that parenting can play in it, like to refer to the things that parents do with the best of intentions to help protect their kids from unpleasant feelings as accommodation. And I like this word, and I think a lot of parents like this word, because the idea is that the parents are accommodating the kid's anxiety. The kid's anxiety is already there. It has some underlying cause other than the parent. And we can talk about how the parents can respond to it in ways that either make it a little bit better or a little bit worse. Interestingly, the research on this finds that almost all parents of anxious children engage in behavior that we would describe as accommodation. Something like 95% of them do. But we also know that the more they do that, the worse the kids' outcomes are over the long term. So cutting back on this behavior can make a really big difference. The other thing to note about accommodation is that it's completely well-intentioned. I mean, this is, as parents, our job. We have evolved to try to prevent our kids from feeling distress. The problem is that we can kind of go overboard, and particularly, you know, in a context of contemporary parenting mores, and also concern about mental health, which can backfire, right? Like, the more concerned we get about kids' stress and anxiety, the more we may paradoxically try to prevent them from that, when that's the thing that actually makes the problem worse. It's an interesting sort of vicious cycle that we find ourselves in.
We're talking to Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic, about her piece, What Happened to American Childhood? Finding Rising Concerns About Anxiety and Other Mental Health Concerns Among American Kids, and looking at some solutions out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your own family's story? If you're the parent of a child who struggles with anxiety or other mental health issues, what's been the most difficult part of that? Have you found things that helped along the way? If you work with kids, is this something you've seen firsthand? What seems to help? What does not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic, about her piece looking at parenting at a time when childhood anxiety disorders have grown more common. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have anxiety or other mental health problems been a struggle for your kid? If you would like to share your story, what kind of things have you seen that can help? Do you have thoughts on why we see so much more anxiety among American kids these days, or questions? And if you work with kids as a teacher in daycare, as a healthcare provider, what are you seeing in your work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kate, I want to get into how some of these solutions work in practice. You gave an example of a family whose kid had a very significant food pickiness, doesn't really sum it up, turkey meatloaf like all the time, and how they accommodated, and then how they started to work through that after getting some help. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, this is a really terrific example. There's a pair of parents who I call in the piece, Angela and Seth, who, when they contacted the SPACE program at Yale, had a 5-year-old boy who for 3 years had eaten virtually nothing but Cheerios for breakfast and turkey loaf for lunch and dinner. The parents calculated that they had prepared this meal for him literally thousands of times. And they had gotten into this strange pattern with the very best of intentions. Their son, Owen, had had some feeding issues as a baby. He was premature and had some issues around that. And over time, they felt that it was their job to make sure that he was well nourished and to make sure that he was comfortable. And this led to this pattern where he didn't know how to deal with food that was unfamiliar, and it actually scared him. I mean, this kid was not just picky. He was actually terrified of unfamiliar foods. And with the help of the researchers at Yale, the parents were able to see that by accommodating this behavior, they weren't really helping Owen to get past it, and they were really hobbling him in the long term. The parents were incredibly down to earth and funny and self-effacing, but also very concerned about the situation. And so what the researchers helped them to do seems really straightforward, but it's actually, I think, not so easy for a family to figure out when they're in the midst of a situation like this. So they, you know, simply began to say that the family, first of all, should make some changes in the way they were approaching mealtime. This seems really basic, but like many families where there are two working parents, one parent had been picking Owen up at daycare, bringing him home, feeding him a dinner of his own, and then the parents had been eating after he went to bed. And they changed that pattern. They all began eating together, and they said, look, there'll be various foods on the table, and you can pick from among the foods that are on the table. But if you want to eat something, it's going to be one of the foods that are on the table. We're not going to cook you something separate. And when dinner time is done, dinner time is done. And it worked rather miraculously. Now, Owen is not ever going to be an omnivore. He is still what you would call a picky eater. But in day-to-day life, in most situations, he can find something that he is able to eat now. And this has these sort of fascinating ripple effects for the rest of his life. It makes it easier for Owen to go to school and to function well at school. It makes it easier for him to go to birthday parties. And in turn, the whole family is much happier. They can go out more easily and life is less stressful. And that has these sort of just wonderful continuing effects.
That points toward a common theme in American parenting. You point out in your piece on this that sometimes it's that making something work now versus the long-term plan. So, like, we only have so much time to have dinner as a family. Let's accommodate and not make it a battle. Or we want the kid to get sleep tonight. We want us to get sleep tonight. So tonight it's easier to accommodate the fear of the dark by letting the kids sleep in our room. This is a common theme behind a lot of these stories, right?
It came up again and again and again with families and clinicians in this one program that I've been talking about, but in a bunch of other cases as well. And it certainly rings true to me in terms of my own experiences as a parent and those of my friends. I think that when we're parenting in a very time-impoverished way, we just, as you say, we want to get through the day. And when we have limited time with our kids, we want that time to be as pleasant as possible. So our desire to have a knockdown, drag-down fight about whether it's turkey loaf for dinner or not may be kind of limited. I think the patterns that people get into around bedtime can be very similar. The patterns people get into around that sort of frenzied, miserable time in the morning when everybody's trying to get out the door to work and to go to school can be similarly, you know, short-term gain, long-term pain. That's a reversal of a phrase that people who work with anxiety tend to use. They like to talk about how short-term pain, that is learning to confront your fears and deal with things that you really, really find stressful and unpleasant now, can make you much more healthy and resilient in the long term. Unfortunately, a lot of us are doing the reverse, right? We're privileging getting the kid to sleep tonight or getting everybody out the door over the kid learning how to do certain things for him or herself.
Talking to Kate Julian for The Atlantic, talking about anxiety and American kids. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering how cognitive behavioral therapy helped particularly in adults who might have grown up with anxiety. Personally, in stressful situations, it's hard for me to even recall what happened. I had to tell somebody to get a little bit out of my personal space or give me a little bit more personal space today, and I can't even remember exactly what I said to them. I almost have to script my response ahead of time, and then afterwards I don't know if I stuck to that script, kind of. Can you tell me more about how cognitive behavioral therapy might help somebody to stay a little bit more present when things get anxious?
John, thanks for that call. So for that adult who grew up with childhood anxiety, still dealing with it now, it sounds like, Kate.
Yeah, so I think cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety is quite effective for adults and kids. There are a number of different tactics that therapists use with people with anxiety in the CBT toolkit. A lot of them involve sort of just identifying patterns of thinking that may be maladaptive and that may lead to stress or anxiety in the moment that's out of proportion with what the situation really warrants. Some of it can be, I'm not sure how each of these things apply to the situation that you experience today, but some of it can be sort of a matter simply of learning to kind of avoid black and white thinking or catastrophizing, trying to sort of come up with counterexamples that demonstrate that things are maybe not quite as bad as they seem or that the stakes are not as high as they may seem. In some cases with cognitive behavioral therapy, people will also, if they're very, very anxious about social interactions or about something going wrong, the therapist may work with them to actually do sort of exposure therapy, they call it, where they go and they sort of practice doing things that are embarrassing or awkward or difficult so that they can realize, that was unpleasant. But you know what? I made it through and the world didn't end. And the feelings of anxiety that were sort of peaking before this unpleasant interaction passed. And I feel fine now. I could do that again.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate you sharing that with us. Kate, I want to spend our last couple minutes on talking to kids about difficult times and situations. You talk about that some in your piece. I'm guessing you started reporting this out before novel coronavirus was a household word. But based on what you heard from the experts, what are ways to, you know, talk to kids in safe ways, younger kids, about a situation like this?
Yeah, so it is interesting. This piece I wrote before the current pandemic, but the last section of it does talk about this question of how, in our effort to prevent our kids' discomfort in much the same ways that I've been talking about throughout this conversation, we may avoid topics that we think are stressful or dark or tricky. There's an anecdote I share in the piece about some research done around the Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco in 1989 that looked at how kids who grappled with that tragedy, who lived in the area and grappled with that tragedy honestly, did much better in the weeks and months that followed. And I think there's something to that in the current situation as well. I've had the privilege to speak in the past few weeks with a bunch of people who were involved in this piece, clinicians, researchers, experts again, and to ask them for their advice on how to talk to kids about COVID. And I think the short answer they said is, please, by all means, talk to them. There's an unfortunate phenomenon going on right now where a lot of parents are worried to be honest about the uncertainty and some of the more worrisome aspects of the current situation. But the sort of short and long and short of it is that kids are smart and they're observant. They can tell that things are not normal now. Even very young children can. So we should try to model for them as best we can our own calm in the face of uncertainty. And we should also be candid about the things that we don't know. Finally, and this may be emotionally the most difficult part for parents, kids tend, even in the best of circumstances outside of this context, to think about what would happen if, for example, their own parents were to die. This is a kind of universal childhood fear. We should talk to them about that. They've already gone there. Parents tend to worry about bringing up unpleasant or scary topics with kids because they think that they might be introducing the topic to the child. That's almost never the case, especially when it comes to this issue. So talk to your kid. You know, tell them what the plan would be if something like that happened.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic. She talked with us about her cover story for The Atlantic's May edition about youth anxiety and parenting, headlined What Happened to American Childhood. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about their proposal to reopen the state's economy starting next week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what if the secret to making your cooking even better wasn't more recipes, but just a few flavor-boosting pantry items? We hear a few items the Bon Appetit staff have been using to spice up their own cooking lately. First, all businesses in Wisconsin would be allowed to reopen a week from today under a plan from the state's largest business group. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce rolled out its back-to-business proposal on Friday, the day Governor Evers' safer-at-home plan was first set to expire. The WMC plan calls for businesses to implement measures to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. The Safer at Home order is in place through Memorial Day weekend, though certain provisions have been relaxed, including a few more announced today, effective Wednesday. Last week, the Evers administration introduced its own plan to reopen the economy. It requires drops in positive COVID-19 tests as a percentage and reductions of new infections with flu-like symptoms. The Department of Workforce Development says nearly 400,000 initial unemployment claims have been filed from mid-March through mid-April. Scott Manley is Executive Vice President of Government Relations at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Scott, good to have you back with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you give us the elevator pitch for this back-to-business plan from WMC?
Yeah, it's our plan basically says, you know, every business should be allowed to reopen, but we need to take a look at what that risk is on an individual by individual business, as well as what is the risk in their particular community. Because one of the things that has been really striking about Wisconsin's experience with COVID-19 is that lots of counties are having a very different experience from one another. So our plan basically says, let's take a look at the type of business and the risk associated with that type of business and take into account other factors like what is the infection rate in the county that business is operating in? And what is the population density of that county that the business is operating in? And finally, what is the hospital capacity and the ability of local hospitals to treat patients in that county? And take all of those factors together and give businesses a risk score of either minimal, moderate, and substantial. And then based on what that risk score is, the business would have different mitigation requirements that they would be needing to implement as a condition of being in business. And so the higher your risk, the more mitigation activities that the business would need to do in order to protect their employees and the general public, the customers who would be visiting their business.
So under your plan, who would evaluate the risk and then who would enforce it to make sure those mitigation measures are actually implemented?
So the risk scores would be determined by publicly available data. So the infection rate piece of the score, the Department of Health Services keeps that data and updates it every single day. Same thing as the hospital utilization scores for things like how many ICU beds are available, how many ventilators are available in any given county, what the PPE supplies are. You know, all of that information is available online, and it's updated every single day. In terms of like the risk factor associated with different types of businesses, the Census Bureau has a classification system, and they divide businesses up into 311 different categories of business. And our plan assigns a low, medium, or high risk score to each of those 311 different business types based on OSHA's guidelines for COVID-19 in the workplace. And then those scores were then reviewed by medical experts, and we sought their advice, and then they provided additional input on that. In terms of who enforces it, you know, this would be done at the local level by local public health departments. They're the ones that are really in the position to make sure that people are following these types of public health based requirements.
And would they have to sign off before the business reopens, or do they do spot checks? What would that local health department do to make sure this was being observed?
Well, it's just like any other. I mean, we've got, you know, thousands and thousands of different health codes all across Wisconsin that are enforced locally. And that's, that's being done even today, you know, before this virus hit. And it's done on a complaint basis. It's done on the basis of spot checks. But as we envision this, is if there was a business that wasn't doing what they were supposed to do, either their employees or the businesses or the people visiting that business, you know, would be able to file a complaint and say, hey, this business isn't doing the social distancing that they're required to do, or they're operating above the capacity for their business that they're required to do. And people would know what those are, because under our plan, the risk scores that businesses are given, they would have to post that risk score on, you know, like the front door or front window of their business, so that members of the general public could see how they score.
Talking to Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about their new proposal to reopen businesses around the state, the Back to Business Plan. You are aiming for, I think, the beginning of next week to have this in place. Is that right?
Yeah, we think that would be ideal. Correct.
And why that date in particular?
Well, because every day that we wait, we have people losing their livelihoods. I mean, we've got a situation now in Wisconsin where our unemployment rate is over 18%. We've had over 400,000 people file for unemployment since mid-March. We know that people who track foot traffic data based on the GPS and cell phones, that we've seen a 50% reduction in foot traffic at retail businesses. since the beginning of March. That's closer to a 70% reduction for restaurants. And a study that just came out last week that was conducted, a survey by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and UW Oshkosh, found that one in three businesses that are closed right now are likely to never reopen again if the stay-at-home orders remain in place. So there are, you know, we're all very concerned about the public health aspects of COVID-19, but I think we need to be equally concerned about the economic health aspects of this, because literally hundreds and thousands of people in Wisconsin are facing financial hardship because of what's happened with the requirement that people stay at home.
One concerns that's been raised is one business that has been able to stay open, meatpacking plants. Of course, this is an essential part of the food supply chain. But we've seen outbreaks surrounding a lot of these plants, Wisconsin, South Dakota, elsewhere in the Midwest. And now some of these places have closed not because of stay-at-home orders, but because of the disease itself. Are you worried that reopening businesses without testing in place could risk replicating that at other, especially large-scale businesses?
Well, we do have testing in place in Wisconsin, and testing is increasing just about every single day. The way our plan works, though, is that businesses' risk scores, which they're required to update every week, are driven by what is the infection rate that's happening in the county that they operate in, and what is the hospital utilization factors that exist for the county that they're operating in. So if we do see an outbreak, as there's been in Brown County in the last couple of weeks, that will get picked up in the data, and the risk scores for businesses in Brown County will go up. And as the risk scores for businesses in Brown County go up, then correspondingly, the restrictions on their business go up and increase, and the mitigation steps that businesses would be required to do, including restrictions on their operational capacity, would happen. So the way our plan works, you know, if we do have a flare up or a hot spot, the model responds to that, the plan responds to it, and businesses are required to act accordingly. The good thing about it, though, is that for all of the other areas of the state where they aren't experiencing a flare up, we're not penalizing them requiring them to engage in the types of restrictions that are causing hundreds of thousands of people to lose their jobs. So we think it strikes the appropriate balance by recognizing the risk associated with certain types of business, but also recognizing that different regions of the state are, you know, experiencing very different infection and transmission rates. And we think that we need to recognize those differences if we want to protect people's livelihoods.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Manley, Executive Vice President of Government Relations at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. We talked to them about WMC's back-to-business plan. It would allow state businesses to reopen starting next week with safeguards aimed at mitigating the spread of COVID-19. Coming up, if you're feeling stuck in a cooking rut, an editor from Bon Appetit has a few suggestions for some items to add to your playlist, condiments, sauces, and different ways to add flavor to the same old, same old. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the federal aid program for farmers affected by the coronavirus outbreak, a program with direct payments to farmers that are expected to be in the tens of billions of dollars. First, maybe you thought you could literally never get tired of eating pasta or whatever your go-to standby might be. But when you're cooking most every meal at home and making runs to the grocery as rarely as possible, we can start to get tired of the same thing again and again. Our next guest has some ideas for magical ingredients that can add new life to old recipes. We want to hear from you, too, if you have one of them. If you have a pantry item you rely on to spice things up a bit, maybe a particular spice or condiment or sprinkle of something, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eliza Abarbanel is the assistant editor at Bon Appetit's Healthy-ish. She's going to share at least some of the 17 pantry staples the staff are relying on right now. Eliza, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, these 17 ideas cover a lot of ground. Can you talk about this this idea of that one ingredient that you can have around that can add new life to a lot of different kinds of dishes?
Sure. I think, you know, there are kind of two kinds of pantry staples. There are the canned chickpeas, the beans, the pasta that you eat every day. And then there are the supercharged ingredients that we're adding to everything else. And myself and my coworkers are definitely passionate about having a big lineup of condiments and spices and sprinkles on hand. And this list is kind of just a compilation of our greatest hits right now.
And a fun thing about this is, you know, you're not just buying this one unique ingredient to make this one unique recipe, right? This is something that it's going to be flexible and add to a lot of different kinds of dishes.
Absolutely. You know, I think tahini is a good example of something that I use at least once a day. But, you know, I could be stirring some of this sesame seed paste into a blueberry smoothie in the morning. And then for lunch, maybe I'll use it to make a quick dressing for a salad or for a grain bowl. And then for dinner.
Oop, Eliza's breaking up.
Putting it on top of that.
Sorry, you broke up just a bit there. And can you talk about what the tahini adds? I mean, I think it is this kind of creamy thing, but it's got a flavor too. Can you talk about what tahini adds to these different dishes and smoothies and whatnot?
Sure. You know, I think the creaminess and the texture of it is very good on one level, just because you can use it to make an emulsified dressing, but then it has that kind of savory, nutty flavor, almost like a peanut butter, if you will, that I find delicious with just about everything. But I also really love peanut butter and all kinds of nut butters too.
Now, another one that you added to the Bon Appetit list here, I think a lot of people have some kind of chilies or chili powder or chili flakes they add to a lot of different things. You've got a particular one that I got to admit I'm not familiar with, Calabrian. Am I saying it right? Chilies?
Yeah, you know, I think your guess is as good as mine. I would say Calabrian chilies. And I really do love cooking with dried chilies. I have maybe four or five kinds in my pantry right now, but these Calabrian chilies are whole chilies packed in safflower oil, and they're incredibly spicy and very fresh and fruity. It almost is herbaceous, and I don't have any herbs on hand right now, but I can chop up some of those chilies and, you know, I added them to a pasta last night, and it had that very fresh, fiery quality that I really crave.
Now, for people, you know, I used to be able to eat spicier food. I can't like I used to could. Can a little bit go a long way here with these Calabrian chilies?
Yes, a little bit definitely goes a long way. And because they're packed in oil, if you don't want to chop up even half a chili and have those seeds, which carry a lot of the heat, you can just spoon out a little bit of the oil and add that into your pasta, and it'll still infuse everything with that flavor.
And then another one that you added to the list is harissa. Now, this is one I've heard of, but I got to say, I don't think I've ever used it. Can you tell us about harissa?
Yeah, harissa comes normally in a jar. It is a pepper paste that comes from North Africa that has bell peppers mixed with chili peppers and garlic. And, you know, something that's good about it is that the heat level can really vary dramatically depending on the brand that you're buying from the store. So especially if you are a little adverse to heat, you can opt for a mild one, which will have much more of that bell pepper flavor than the chili pepper, and use that to toss it in vegetables before you roast them. Or I really like to make meatballs and put a couple spoonfuls of harissa into the meatball mix, and then they come out beautifully browned and delicious.
Yeah, there's one recipe we noticed that's one of the meatballs, a sheet pan chicken meatballs with tomatoes and chickpeas. What does the harissa do for that?
That is such a good recipe. It's kind of embarrassing how much I serve it to my friends, but the harissa goes into the chickpeas and the tomatoes in addition to the meatballs themselves. So everything kind of roasts on one sheet pan and gets caramelized, and the pepper flavor deepens as you're roasting it. So it kind of makes this delicious homogeneous tray of goodness.
Yum. Don't be embarrassed about serving that. I would gladly eat that right now. Eliza of Barbanel
You
is with
should come
us.
over.
Eliza of Barbanel is with us from Bon Appetit. She's sharing some great ingredients that add a lot to a lot of different kinds of dishes. By the way, that recipe we just mentioned and a bunch of others, they're up on the Bon Appetit website. You can find that linked, by the way, at the Central Time website. You can find that WPR.org/Central Time. You can get that and many other recipes there. We heard from Gary, who called in and couldn't stay on the line. He said he loves tagine. He says it's a Mexican spice blend that gives a little bit of lime, acidic flavor, which is great when you don't have so many fresh things on hand. Tagine, is that one you're familiar with?
Yeah, tagine, is so good. It's really good on fresh fruit, actually, if you like that kind of sweet, spicy, salty flavor.
That sounds great. Now, another one, I think this is from one of your colleagues, shared miso. And I often have a thing of miso, like that goopy version of it, that you can really quick make soup with. And that's all I usually do with it. Can you talk about that as an additional ingredient in other recipes?
Absolutely. Miso is something that, you know, I think a lot of people love because it has this really umami-packed kind of sweet flavor. And if you like miso soup but want to try other things, you can stir it into salad dressings. It also is surprisingly good in sweet applications. Miso nut butter, if you are tired of your, if you are making your own peanut butter and blend a spoonful of miso, that's a great way to do it. Also, if you're making a fruit crumble, you can add miso into the crumble topping, and it's very delightful and surprising.
Oh, that sounds great. Let's pick one more. Now, sesame seeds, the humble sesame seed. I have them in my spice cabinet, and I never really know what to do with them. What can I do with those sesame seeds to make another dish pop?
I would really encourage you to add them to basically anything that you're making, but make sure that they're toasted first. I don't know if yours come toasted. If they don't, it's pretty easy to just put them on a sheet pan and toast them in the oven, which I find gets them more evenly toasted than doing them on the stove, but whatever works best for you. And that really brings out that nutty flavor. And I really like to add sesame seeds to salads, especially when I don't have breadcrumbs on hand, just for a little bit of texture and crunch.
Now, am I toasting those on a high heat for a little time or a low heat for a long time?
If you're doing them in the oven, I would do them around 300 or 350 Fahrenheit, and just kind of keep an eye on them and shake them, and they'll go pretty fast. I can tell you've been burned before with sesame seeds. Who hasn't?
Maybe you can give me a bit of advice. I have a magic ingredient that I put in everything, either sauerkraut or kimchi. Like, I found great live culture ones. I would put them in everything if I could. But then there's my family who don't want the taste. They don't want the smell in the house. Is there another ingredient that can give me some of, I don't know what that is, the acid and that fermented flavor without offending 75% of my household? I'm putting you on the spot here.
No, I think something that you might want to try instead of trying to get an ingredient that isn't quite as fermented, which I think that's the quality that you really love about it, is if you rinse kimchi or sauerkraut with a little bit of water, that will kind of take some of that aggressive fermented flavor off of it and still, you know, leave it inside, and it kind of will be toned down. And I also really like making quesadillas with kimchi in them. And that might be a good way to convince people to give it a try with a lot of cheese.
That sounds like a good plan. Or I may just stick with the current plan where Rob goes on the back porch to eat his kimchi. Eliza, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eliza Barbanel, assistant editor of Healthy-ish, Bon Appetit's wellness site. You can find the full list of the 17 recommended pantry ingredients over at our website, WPR.org/Central Time. Bon Appetit has this list of a bunch of ingredients you could maybe pick up next time you venture to the grocery store, and recipes to go along with a lot of them. You can share yours, by the way, if you have that magical ingredient that zests up even the most boring dish, or the one you've had again and again and again, maybe in recent days in particular. Let us know what it is. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Got an email from a listener who says the best way to use sesame seeds is to add them to bread dough with aged Swiss cheese. Ooh, that sounds really good. Sesame Swiss bread. I would eat that. Well, how about you? Share yours. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Last night, I went outside to dump some compost into the compost bin. I looked up at the night sky and saw some clouds parting and some stars. And that's all I saw. But some people saw more than that last night, including Central Time producer Dean Kinetter. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
All right. So you were looking at the night sky and you saw something weird. What did you see?
I was lucky enough to be outside toasting a marshmallow by the fire. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, out of the night sky, I saw a string of lights emerge, travel across the whole length of the horizon, maybe 30 or 40 little dots of light, and then disappear into the night.
Okay, now what are you thinking when you see this?
At first, I was flabbergasted and was calling out to anyone around me to check this out. But after a while, I realized these had to be satellites because of how low they were, and they were keeping a consistent distance from one another. They weren't getting closer or farther away. They were just moving in unison like a train across the sky. It was amazing.
And now you looked into this and found out what they were, right?
Yeah, my suspicions were confirmed. They were a train of satellites apparently launched by SpaceX earlier this month.
Now, those are controversial. I know Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, are the Starlink satellites. Are you going to go out and try to see them again? Or do you know they're going to be in our neighborhood again soon?
Oh, I'm not sure if it's possible, but I'll look it up and I would definitely go check it out again. It was a pretty cool sight.
Well, either way, you get the marshmallows. Thanks a lot, Dean.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.